Hi, I'm Ross Reynolds. As a child of the 60s, the 1969 mission to the moon was a landmark event in my life. I'll always remember watching it on a black and white TV at Camp Chimney Corners. So it was a huge thrill for me to hear the second man on the moon, Buzz Aldrin, describe the landing.
The landing was really the challenge, and everything had been done up to that point by Apollo 10. So we're coming down, and we rolled around so that we're no longer looking down at the surface. We were looking up and approaching the point of pitching forward to be able to see the surface more clearly. When the landing radar was locking on and beginning to feed information, we started getting computer alarms. And it turns on a general alarm bell or a beep-beep and alerts a amber light in the cockpit. And you hear this, and then you immediately know what it is because the computer also stops showing what it's been showing, and it flashes, and you have a number come up that tells you what the number of the alarm is. And it was Greek to us. We didn't know what 1201 meant. And, immediately you know, something's wrong. So we asked Houston to tell us what the problem was. And fortunately, some people had looked at that, were able to say, yes, sort of, I understand what it is. It doesn't look real serious, and give them a go. So we got a go on that alarm, continued on.
Also, you were practically out of fuel by the time you touched down.
This showed up later. After we took over, as expected, as anticipated, at 500 feet, it was the time and we decided ahead of time that would be where Neil would take over control and manually fly it down to a landing point. And as he took over, he saw that it was a good idea maybe to land a little further down so we would go past this field of boulders and the crater that he went back and looked at later. And, of course, this plus, I think, an inherent difficulty in the navigation that was already causing us to land a little bit long, but we didn't know it. All of this contributed to the descent taking a little longer, and of course, the longer the rocket burns, the more fuel it takes. So we reached a point of diminishing fuel sooner than maybe we thought, and we got that call out 60 seconds, and we were still 100 feet in the air, coming down slowly. And by the time the call of 30 seconds came out, we were still 10 feet, 15 feet in the air. But that time I could see we were going to make it.
Buzz, you were thinking about the computer running. You were thinking about all of the technical things that were of a concern while you were on the moon. Were there ever any moments where you were able to enjoy yourself and say, hey, we're the first men on the moon and have fun there?
Yes, that came soon. It came not until we had crossed the several discrete times after touchdown, if you want to leave and join up with the other spacecraft, there's certain times when it's better than other times. And all of these happen two or three times within the first 2 minutes after you touch down. From that point on, then it's relaxing because you're not going to lift off unless something's really wrong until Mike Collins comes around again. So it was after that point, and of course by that time we'd heard about the faces about to turn blue in the control room, and Neil had said, Houston, Tranquility Base, the Eagle has landed. And that was sort of a certification that indeed we were on the ground, as if they didn't already know that. So there was this moment, and before we started doing other things, I just sort of looked over and patted Neil on the back, and we looked at each other and silently sort of said, hey, we made it.
That must have been a powerful moment for you.
Yes, it was. It was. And those come so fast, and they're there in an instant, and they're gone. And it's a communication by eyesight transmission as much as anything else.
What was it like moving around on the moon? You were about 60% of your body weight on Earth, but you had the same kind of bulk you would have on Earth, so it was a little difficult for you.
Well, actually, the six is right, but it was 1/6, so it's about 16% of our weight. So everything we had on would have weighed about 360 pounds on the Earth. So it was about 60 pounds there. So the mass that we had, and a lot of it was on the backpack, it tended to distort our center of gravity. So to compensate for that, you had the lean forward a little bit, which looked a little unnatural. As you would rock a little bit from one side to the other, you wouldn't get the strong feedback from your feet as to when you were approaching losing your balance. And if you lost your balance a little bit on the moon, it was a simple matter to just push off and put your foot underneath you because you weren't coming down in a hurry. Things just happened like in slow motion. The suit was a constraint, and it wouldn't let you move fast. So after I was on the surface and looked at where my feet were and held the edge of the struts and landing gear, then I started doing what I had set about to do, and that was where the camera was located, to begin to move in a way and change direction, looking at different ways of transporting myself on the surface. And it went from sort of a loping one foot in front of the other, conventional. I tried hopping with 2 feet at the same time.
Was it difficult for you to adjust to such a high point in your life?
I think, welcomed the isolation that we had initially because of maybe not a correct concern or fear or whatever on the part of a few people that there might be germs on the moon that could cause some sort of toxin or hazardous condition. If they could survive on the moon, they must be very strong. And if they infected somebody on Earth, they could, you know, just maybe potentially cause the green cheese plague, you know, that would wipe all over the world. That didn't happen, but it did give us a separated, a protected period of about, it was exactly 21 days from the time we left the moon. And that was totally arbitrary because a lot of diseases take that long to, so quarantine is what we were put in for that. That enabled us to adjust a little bit to right after coming back, and then we were thrust into, can I go buy a suit without the Italian photographers in their little car finding me or chasing me or hounding me? And I remember dodging in and out of the airbase and telling the guard, don't let those guys follow me. And then we went on this around-the-world trip, and that was very high pressure, I think, one city after another, meeting kings and queens and always on show and having to look. The airplane, Air Force One, was our home, even though we didn't spend the night there. It was in some hotel, but the hotel was, again, another place where if you opened the door, somebody was usually outside trying to take your picture or get an autograph. So 45 days of this, it was sort of nice to get back home, but then that really didn't ease up. There were other things always going on, and the three of us decided not to even think of staying on the crew schedule for maybe flying another mission. But being around NASA in a crew position meant if you didn't have an assignment, you were available for speaking engagements, tours, and there were certainly lots of those. I wanted to get about other things. So they looked around and they assigned me to command the test pilot school. Sounded okay, you know, great. But I had never had that sort of training before. So here I was going to command a school that I hadn't any knowledge, really, intimate. This is airplane testing. And I had been away from the service, really, for 11 years. And I really hadn't had command positions in the NASA program. And it was a very demanding position for somebody who's on the pedestal already. Mm-hmm. You know. And I was trying to live up to that. So things were a bit of a letdown, and I, after a while at the test pilot school, I decided that I'd sort of had enough of this competitiveness, and I wanted to leave the service and write a story about it, and I wrote an autobiography and tried to evaluate what it was like to come back from going to the moon and have things sort of not work out the way they you'd like them to, maybe. And going from a very structured life to the free life sort of an author, where even when you're working with someone else, you're wondering, okay, now what is today going to be? Well, it's going to be whatever you make it. It's going to be what you put together. And if you choose not to do anything, then that's what happens that day. Now, that isn't the way it happens when you're in the military or at NASA. And the change from very structured to not so very structured wasn't exactly what I needed at that point. I needed something to focus my attention on.
What happened then?
Well, it was why I was writing the book. I had a sense of something that I wasn't sure what was going on, and I wasn't feeling good about things. I was feeling discouraged. In a word, I felt depressed from time to time. So I wanted to get some kind of help for this, and I wanted to do this, and it looked like I had things fairly under control. And I was in the process of writing about this in the book. And the Mental Health Association said, hey, boy, we really like to see you come along. You're a recognized person in name, and we'd like to use you to be on our board of directors. And then my book came out, and, oh, we'd like to use you to be our symbol, our national chairman. Well, that was the last thing I really needed, was to be, quote, used in a way as a showpiece, really. Turned out I was not prepared to be a showpiece for that sort of thing, because what was really happening in retrospect now, from my position with over 10 years of sobriety, was the progression, the gradual progression of a genetic tendency toward alcoholism. And it didn't really get me into deep trouble anywhere while I was in the service of NASA or in the Air Force. It was an off-duty kind of thing that was just served as a means of escape. But once I went from a structured life to an unstructured life, it began to take over more and more, and it went its normal progression. And but now the recovery has gone its normal progression, and I couldn't be more thankful for the opportunity to have been required for survival, to go through an evaluation of myself and a reprioritizing. That's a lousy government word, but but I had to do that, and I had to appreciate that in order to hold on to things, you have to give them away. In order to be a winner, you have to lose some things, and these indirect things that you learn in the process of sharing with other people.
It's hard for me to think about the space program that culminated in your trip to the moon outside of its times in some ways. It was an era in which America was flush. It was the preeminent power in the world. It was a period of social change, John Kennedy coming in with a fresh new leadership approach. Do you think that that kind of adventure, that kind of task will ever be possible again in America, given the times that we're in now, where America is no longer considered to be the preeminent power in the Western world? I have a hard time imagining George Bush saying, within 10 years we'll be on Saturn or whatever.
Well, maybe we're not as preeminent as we may have thought we were then. We had a much greater leadership in electronics then. We don't have that now. We had a going automobile industry, and we're sort of threatened. The TV industry's gone. I hope that the aircraft industry doesn't fade away and get absorbed by foreign developers and lose that leadership in this nation. And I certainly hope that the new ocean of space doesn't by default fall to foreign pioneering frontiersmen. I think we need that pioneering spirit in this country to chart a course for Mars and then move outward and do a lot of looking back at the Earth and evaluating our environment while we're moving to Mars. And I'm sure we'll plant some settlements on the moon en route, and we'll do that with the sort of things that will help us get to Mars.
Thank you very much, Buzz Aldrin.